Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Sue Elliott. I'm the Acting Vice Chancellor and the Acting Provost, in fact, acting quite a few things, at the University of Melbourne. And it's a great delight to open this In the Spotlight World Vision Seminar today on community development. One of the most exciting things, I think, about working at the university is that frisson of excitement as you walk around and you meet people that you would otherwise only see on the 7:30 report or read in The Australian or The Age, who are national and international leaders in their discipline or in their contribution, in their advocacy, in a whole range of spheres. And today is an opportunity to meet such international experts and people who are truly giving to the world's poor. World Vision is well known to us all through the child sponsorship, also through the 40-hour famine, which many of us in this room may have done when we were younger, or now have children who are undertaking it. World Vision, however, does much more than this in terms of trying to alleviate suffering and to bring about an end to poverty. And we'll be hearing more about those approaches today. But you'll know that they work both internationally and domestically. And the university has been growing a partnership, a relationship with World Vision. As part of our overriding strategy, growing esteem, we have three planks, or three strands: the research, teaching and learning, and also knowledge transfer. And it's through knowledge transfer we perhaps best express our public-spiritedness. We work to increase intellectual capital and to make a difference in communities. And it's in this particular strand that we come so closely aligned with what World Vision is seeking to do. So it's through events such as this that we're growing this partnership. We've had a number of free films for students to come and see. We've got a number of other public events in which the university is working with World Vision. And as you came through, you may have seen the table Youth Decide, which one of our speakers will be talking about today. We have in our graduate attributes, our graduate statements for our students, that all University of Melbourne graduates will be prepared to be leaders in the community and will be attuned to global issues and will be prepared to be global citizens. These are highly aspirational goals, the ones which we believe in very strongly, but I don't think any of us fail to see that these are very high aspirations that are difficult to always achieve just through classroom activities. So it's through the external out-of-classroom opportunities we have for leadership, for volunteering, for being engaged in public discussions such as this, that we hope our students will achieve the aspirations that we have for them. So it's with great pleasure that I introduce our three speakers. The first, the Reverend Tim Costello, you will all have heard of. Director of World Vision, or the CEO of World Vision Australia, and well known for his advocacy against poverty, against disadvantage, suffering, gambling, a whole range of social issues that have brought him to the forefront for very many years in Australia and internationally. Dr. David Lansley, senior economist at World Vision Australia, also brings a long history of working with corporates and other organisations. And Ms. Rodo Quarambra, who is born in Zimbabwe and is now working as the National Director of World Vision Uganda. I'd like to just state an apology that I'm unable to stay because of an engagement I do need to attend, but I'm absolutely delighted this will be recorded, so I'll be able to watch it later and be able to see the interaction you have with these three outstanding speakers. So thank you very much, and welcome to the university.
Thank you very much and good afternoon. I'm still overwhelmed by your lavish facilities here. I haven't been in this building. I have memories of older, more wooden structures in Melbourne University Commerce. I joined World Vision Australia in April of last year, and there have been constant crises since then. Now, of all audiences, this one doesn't need to be told that correlation doesn't mean causation, but I still get nervous. The first GFC, the global food crisis, is still going. It's fallen off the front pages of the newspapers and it's dropped out of the headlines, but for many millions of people around the world, it's still very much alive and as intense as it was a year ago. For people in the developed world, they saw prices, food prices rise, peak about June or September of last year, and then come off reasonably quickly by a half or perhaps a little more in some cases. But for a lot of people in the developing world, they are still seeing very high prices for the basic foodstuffs, things like wheat, rice, corn, millet, sorghum, that makes up the bulk of their diet. Now, I guess once an economist, always an economist, I get quite excited about a thing that the FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organisation of the UN, has done. They've developed this terrific little database, well, it's not that small really, that you can go to and you can dial in a country and you can find out what their main foodstuffs are and you can get prices, retail or wholesale, for many countries and even in different parts of the country. So you can get an idea what's happening on the ground in terms of food prices. And what we're discovering in many countries, from Burkina Faso to Pakistan to Togo, that the prices are not coming down. Now, there's a mixture of reasons for this. In some cases, it's civil unrest and internal violence that's disrupting food markets and keeping prices high. In some cases, they've had bad seasons. They're still suffering from drought or from flooding, which is having an impact. Input prices of fertilisers and seeds are still often high, and some countries have had their currencies fall against the US dollar. So consequently, if they're dependent on imports, they're still paying a lot more and not getting anywhere near the full benefit of declining world US dollar prices. But whatever mix of reasons, when you look at a lot of countries, some have seen only a modest fall in their main foodstuffs. Some have actually seen prices continue to rise. So for them, the food crisis is still very real indeed. And of course, there's a lot of other factors that contributed to the crisis in the first place that are still either active or dormant and waiting to come back. So, for example, when you look at the trends in corn-based ethanol production, that is still alive and well. It's taking food out of the food chain and turning it into ethanol to supplement liquid fuels, basically going into cars. That has had a big impact on corn prices, and of course, substitutes for corn, wheat and rice has also tended to push their prices up. That's still growing quite strongly. And as oil prices continue to rebound, that's making ethanol production more economic and likely to take even more corn out of production, or if there is new land being brought in, to result in more degradation of tropical rainforests in the Amazon and Indonesia in particular. So we've still got all that stuff happening. We've still got inadequate research and development in agriculture. That became very apparent when the crisis started and people began to ask, why are we seeing this huge surge in food prices? A drop-off in spending in agricultural research and development came to the fore as one of the long-term causes. That has been contributing to a slowing in the rate of productivity growth in agriculture, such that it's not really keeping up with population growth. So we've got those pressures still in the background, still working, and they're long-term causes which will take long-term solutions. If we look at some of the other factors that are maybe dormant, we've got reduced demand from China and India, particularly China, for foodstuffs, but as China recovers and as the world economy picks up, we have that likely to come back to the fore as well. So this food crisis isn't over. For some, it hasn't even had much offset, and for the rest, a lot of those forces are there waiting to resurge and push prices back up again, with the risk that we start seeing things like food riots, as we saw last year, and further increases in a lot of basic foodstuffs from a high base already. And of course, we've got tragic evidence of the impact of high food prices. Literally today, when we heard that 20 people were suffocated in Pakistan over a rush to get free flour that was being handed out. So we've still got one GFC happening. And that is giving rise to a fairly sombre view of the medium-term outlook for food prices by the FAO. This came out just recently, these forecasts. And they're not really seeing a very strong reaction from the developing countries to increase their output. And it turned out they haven't really been in a position to increase production. All the improvement and all the response to high prices from food producers has come from the developed world. So it's a fairly sombre outlook for food. What about the second GFC, the global financial crisis? We're going to run out of the use of F soon, so it'll become the global debt crisis, I think, is now the new TLA, or three-letter acronym, coming in. But we'll stick with the global financial crisis. A lot of that is still working out. I'm still amazed and still nervous again that we've got out of this so lightly. I cannot believe you can get a shock of this magnitude of a world financial system and just continue to stroll through it as we have. Be that as it may, even if this is the worst of it, we're only still seeing a slowdown in the US. We haven't seen a strong turnaround in the world economy yet. We'll start to see some improvement on current estimates next year. What does this mean to the developing world? Well, the World Bank has made various studies of this. So just looking at some of their comments and their estimates, we've got the world economy possibly contracting by nearly 3%, which is the first time in more than half a century. We've got a massive drop in global trade of nearly 10%. We've got a crisis that's trapping an additional 90 million people in severe poverty. So these are people who otherwise would have been able to get out of the $1.25 a day or less poverty trap, but are being kept there because their incomes are coming under pressure, in part because export markets in the developed countries have dried up and the exports from various parts of particularly Africa are finding less demand. So we've got at least 90 million people. Some estimates are considerably higher than that. Chronic hunger is likely to exceed 1 billion people, with another 1 billion people facing significant malnutrition problems. And we've got GDP growth in 2009 in developing countries expected to fall to 1.2%. So anybody who's looking at the developing world knows that something like 3% is pretty modest growth for that part of the world, down to 1.2%. And we've got significant pressures on external financing as well. Now, that's a fairly somber outlook for the world economy, but I guess the one thing I continue to learn about development when I look at it is that it's a source of surprise. And people like William Easterly, of course, delight in pointing out that all the development experts frequently get it wrong. He had a nice little line in something he wrote talking about how Egypt was able to develop a successful export industry producing bathroom ceramics for Italy. And he said, you could imagine the response that a development expert would have got if they'd gone to the Egyptian government and said, just make toilets for Italy and you'll be right. So we are constantly surprised. We do our best with our programming, but we're constantly learning.
Now, I'm trusting that some of you got to watch Millionaire's Mission, but if you didn't get to watch it, you can talk to one of the young ladies who told me that she stayed in the hotel that was built by these entrepreneurs, actually, when they were out in Uganda. Now, just to pick up from some of the things that David was saying about the two crises, I live and work in Uganda, and the global food crisis is very real, particularly for Uganda. And it's one of those countries that World Vision has defined as a country in crisis because we have had failed harvests for a number of times, particularly in the northeast of Uganda. And currently, World Vision is partnering with the World Food Program to respond with food aid in some of the economies. But beyond food aid, we're trying to actually use some of the Australian government resources to support the farmers to generate sustainable agricultural interventions so that they can farm and produce the right crops for the climate in the northeast of Uganda. Then in the area of the global financial crisis, I think it has a greater impact in the urban areas where people were accustomed to getting remittances from their relatives. But for the poor communities in the rural areas where World Vision works, we find that those communities are highly dependent on subsistence farming. So the issue is, how do they get more of their produce into the market and get some of that money flowing into their local economy at the grassroots level? And it's interesting that when we took these eight entrepreneurs to Uganda, they latched on to the reality that these were subsistence farmers, and how best do you try and multiply or encourage them to think beyond just producing for their consumption and selling very little, often at very low prices? How do we help them link into the market? And the potato storehouse that you saw in the clip was really designed to help the local farmers bring in their potato harvest, keep it in there until the prices were high because the supply was lower, and they would then be able to get more for the crops. And the business people were there in February of 2007. They came back 3 months later, and indeed there were potatoes in the storehouse. So for a while, that project really went well. I've been back in the community that they visited just a month before I came here, and I found that although they were able to market two of the harvests in 2007 and 2008, they really haven't been able to do that very consistently. Because obviously with big groups coming together, there are challenges that can confront them. So what did the entrepreneurs learn, and what did we as World Vision learn from this initiative? I think it was admirable that these millionaires went out to Uganda, gave up time, and tried to see what are the complexities of poverty, and can you apply economic solutions to address poverty. And they did learn that, one, as innovators, they do bring something. Big business can teach something to NGOs, because sometimes as NGOs, we're so caught up in meeting basic human needs like health and education. And you do need to link up with some of the more sustainable economic solutions so you can transition people from just living a subsistence life to beginning to generate some of their own economy at the local level so that they can be able to pay, particularly where governments don't always have the resources to sustain the services that you put in place. So the entrepreneurs did learn that they did have something to bring, but that there are a number of factors that contribute to poverty in the local economy. And therefore, you need a multi-layered approach, and only then can you address the complexity of poverty. When you walk into the economy, people in any rural poor environment are in strata. Some of them are very poor and they're not economically active. Some of them are better off and are already running some form of business. So you want to almost stratify and find out who's ready for business, and then you work with them. And you want to bring them around small business projects that they can get their heads around. And one of the things that came out from the projects which the millionaires did is that the small crafts that they supported the women to work on and market have really done well, because the women could organize themselves, they were a small group, they were supported to learn new skills to produce better crafts, they were linked into a local curio shop that kept coming to the community and buying these crafts, so they were able to market their crafts. The other very successful project was linked to the teach-in hostel, a kind of hotel, that they converted a classroom at the local school, and they were bringing in volunteers, and we have one of the volunteers who stayed there. The volunteers would pay to stay in the teach-in hotel, and then they would be able to teach at the local school. And there were a number of benefits with getting the volunteers to come, because they not only boosted the local economy when they were buying chickens and vegetables from the people, but they were teaching in the school and enrollment went up, because suddenly the society around them was so fascinated because they were teaching them English, and just a lot happened in that economy. They shared out the profits that came out of the teach-in and were able to construct three classroom blocks. So there were things that kept on happening that built on what the small community was doing, and they could get their heads around it, and it was sustainable, particularly because with this teach-in hotel, that one entrepreneur was already in the UK involved in this business of bringing volunteers, continues to market it on their website in the UK. So they generate the volunteers coming to Uganda, and it keeps going. Now, one of the things that was also learned by the entrepreneurs is that if you do service delivery kind of interventions, they went into a maternity ward, they put in electricity, and they put in water. Unless you are in dialogue with local government, once you've put in those things, the day that they don't have money to pay for the electricity gets cut off. The day that the pipe gets broken and no one else repairs it, then there's no water. So I think it boils down to whatever you're going to do in poorer economies, you want to help people to own their own development. You want to put some money into their own pockets so that they can pay for services and continue to generate solutions that work. World Vision as an organization tends to work in communities for a long time, between 10 and 15 years. And one of the things we are finding is that while we do a good job in terms of helping them to meet their basic services, their health, education, we do need to combine this with micro-enterprise development so that for those who are the economically active poor, we can link them into business training. We can link them into microfinance so that they can grow their businesses, so that beyond just employing the husband and the wife, they can employ five people, and they continue to be exposed to business training. You link them into markets, and they're able to really find themselves moving on and then pay for the services that they and their children need. One of the other things that, as World Vision, we continue to be convinced of is that long-term solutions to poverty can only be met if different partners work together. That includes governments because they are the ones with the mandate to provide services. It includes business because they are innovators. And it includes NGOs because we stay in communities long enough to understand them and to translate big ideas into something that works for the local economy. We found out also that you want ideas that are small, that are simple, and that are sustainable, and possibly you can replicate them in different communities. With women, we find that you want to work around their schedules. You want to work with what they're already doing. You want to recognize that they've got other demands on their time, and the idea has to be small enough that they can manage it, but it needs to stretch their minds enough that it takes them out of what they're already doing. So we're finding more and more that as we move forward as an NGO, we'd like to partner better with government so that they can do the things they need to do, and that's where advocacy comes in. We'd like to partner more with big business so they can bring their innovative ideas and try them with us and partner with us as we try and break them down into bite-sized chunks that community members can get their heads around. We would like to continue to reach the hard-to-reach communities because that's what we do as organizations like World Vision. So I'm excited that both the entrepreneurs and those who watch the program learned something about the complexity of poverty. And I also know that as World Vision, we've learned something about big business and their ideas. And the idea is that as we move forward, we'll need to partner better and try and address the different layers of poverty, peel them away, and help communities step out of poverty, but also continue to meet their basic services like health and education, alongside provide opportunities for them to get up in the economic ladder, and maybe we can graduate them and hand them over to banks once microfinance has supported their small businesses. So thank you, and I hope as you continue to reflect and partner with World Vision, you'll know that there's a role for business, there's a role for governments, and there's a role for NGOs. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, David, and thank you, Rudo. And I am sure you've got a number of questions that will allow time to pursue with Rudo and David. Look, I'm just here to be the support act, to try and wrap this up together and throw it over to you for some questions. Some of the things you've heard is macro, global macroeconomic challenges, which are huge. And then in a particular country, some partnership opportunities with a first world business set of people and what's appropriate in a country that is in serious crisis. One of the things that occurs to me, and I think it's obvious to you in the areas you're studying, is the incredible role of trying to join the dots between the local and the particular and the small and the macroeconomic, which is shaping and scripting all of our reality. And to be able to keep both of those pictures in your mind as you think about what you do, how you contribute. I think part of the partnership that's really exciting between World Vision and Melbourne University, that the acting Vice-Chancellor, she was acting everything, I've forgotten what it was now. VC, thank you. So the actor we had here before, she was reminding us that there are some really exciting partnership things happening. You will know, those of you who have studied economics, maybe economic history, that Adam Smith, who wrote The Wealth of Nations, credited with talking about the invisible hand, laissez-faire market capitalism, as a moral philosopher had this insight into humans. And I think it's a very profound insight. Humans are at the same time self-regarding and other-regarding. Self-regarding, selfishness, Adam Smith said, well, it's not through the benevolence of the brewer, the butcher, or the baker we get our beer, our meat, our bread. It's through their self-interest. And self-interest organised in markets, which is the best allocator of preferences, the best and most efficient distributor of resources, is a major alignment with human energy, self-interest, being self-regarding. Adam Smith, who was also a moral philosopher, said, but we are simultaneously other-regarding. There is within us a sense, and we often use the word altruism, of our community, nation, increasingly now our globe. And one of the, I think, interesting things about Adam Smith's insight is that these two things, which have always been two sides of the one coin of humans, are actually coming together to almost have the same focus in our world. They are morphing self-interest and global interest. I often quote Paul Keating, who I think was actually quoting Jack Lang, a former Premier of New South Wales. Keating or Lang, whoever said it first, said this, in a two-horse race, always back the horse called self-interest, because at least you know it's trying. Now, as people who are in economics and management, I think you get that. And you get the energy that flows out of getting alignment between a business idea and the motivation and entrepreneurial investment, the risk-taking that excites someone with the possibilities of a payola, a big self-interest. What we're now seeing, of course, is that this is impossible if we are now not other-regarding. The global food crisis impacts the poor the most. But if we are dealing with their global food crisis and their global financial crisis, which, by the way, started in the West, we've just had the anniversary, haven't we, of Lehman Brothers and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, yet it's the poor who really, really pay with the ultimate bottom line. We talk about super levels back to 2001 and share market levels back to 2003 and we're worried, and yes, that's appropriate. But Bob Zolick said, because of the global financial crisis in the last year, 400,000 children have died who would not have died but for the GFC, global financial crisis. You want to talk about bottom lines, that's it. If we aren't addressing the global food crisis and the global financial crisis, if we aren't finding a way to address the climate change crisis, if we aren't finding a way to address really a trade crisis, a little bit of hopeful news that Doha might kickstart. But here are poor countries essentially working incredibly hard and not getting ahead because we have fixed the rules in trade. If we aren't dealing with these crises, we are now impacted. This is what a global village means. It means no longer can we pull up a drawbridge, say we're okay, we'll just look after ourselves. It's why there is a vote going on started yesterday till the 21st of September. And some of you look to me between the ages of 14 and 28. I know I'm not. I was reminded viciously of that by Virginia Trioli on ABC TV yesterday. I was publicising on TV the global climate change youth decide vote, and Virginia started with, "Tim, you don't look the right age for this." "Well, yes, I'm the CEO of World Vision and we're encouraging it." And she said, "Well, I'm going to add insult to offence. It ain't going to make any difference. The government's not going to listen. That's pointless." I thought, gee, this is a great start to the morning, Virginia. Thanks for the deep, profound cynicism. Well, let me say, it has to make a difference, and it's in our self-interest now to make a difference. We know if Australians, with our per capita carbon footprint, see the rest of the world live with our carbon footprint, we will need seven planets. We haven't got seven planets. Kevin Rudd has made some proposals going to Copenhagen, but even on the best of those proposals, if Australia's footprint is the same as the rest of the world's, on Kevin's proposals, we'll need three planets. We haven't got three planets. This is a profound issue where decisions will be made at Copenhagen that massively impact the poor. It has started. Kofi Annan's Global Human Impact Report released in May said 300,000 people have died in the last year as a direct consequence of climate change. A conservative figure. He said 500 million are at extreme risk. Economic terms, he's an economic faculty, it has already cost, climate change has already cost $100 billion and ticking. We now find that being other-regarding about deals that also allow developing countries, if they sign up at Copenhagen, special graduated targets in terms of emissions, us giving them the technology or selling it cheap, they're going to grow. The only question is it going to be a low-carbon or a high-carbon growing economy? That's the only question. Is no longer just us being charitable. It's also in our self-interest. To be other-regarding lines up with the sustainability of this world for our kids and our grandchildren. That's why I'd encourage you to vote between 14th of yesterday and the 21st in the Youth Decide. We're hoping 50,000 young people between 14 and 28 years of age will vote, saying, "Here is our voice." And you'll see the range of options. Well, climate change, which is also morphed with poverty, is almost the same issue, really then calls forth business ideas that are sustainable, that are lateral, that say if we can't deal with poverty, we and our world will be affected. The poor will go on cutting down the forest. I showed a little clip this morning of a program which will be on TV later this year. Hugh Jackman and his wife, Deb Lee Furness, will be in this program. We're in Ethiopia a month ago. 80 million people, far too little land, 95% of the forest gone. Why? Because the poor who are farming cut down wood for their little stoves, so their meagre food amounts. The forests having gone has dramatically impacted precipitation and rain. So there's now droughts that are occurring every 3 years, 3 or 4 years, whereas they used to be 10 or 15 years. We're there filming World Vision's supplying of methane digesters, hole in the ground, put the manure in, capture the greenhouse gas, so you stop, firstly, a pollutant going up, doing greater damage. The gas is piped into farmers' tiny mud-walled farmhouses with thatch roofs, where normally you see smoke coming out of the thatch because when they cook and burn, there's no windows and you go in and you get these stinging eyes, tears, respiratory diseases that the kids get. With carbon captured, turned into gas, they cook without cutting down the forest. They become an energy supplier. They pay back with their first calf born to their cow, the methane digester, so the village actually benefits, and it's a hand up, not just a hand out. Most people, as Rudo will tell you, are just like us. They don't want to live on aid and charity. They actually want opportunities to work, to trade, to build businesses, just like Australians do and people in the West. So in this film, and I'll be in New York where Hugh's doing some climate change appearances with Blair and Clinton and Bloomberg, and the UN Assembly's focused on climate change next week, we will be saying in a global village, the profound interdependence is no longer inescapable. Some people get sick in Mexico and we close a primary school in Clifton Hill. We decide we're going into Iraq, a foreign policy decision made up here, and Muslim Australians are arrested allegedly for blowing up Australian military bases, or plotting to. We must deal with poverty, or the poor go on cutting down the forest. And if the forests in Indonesia and Brazil and Africa go, we are impacted. Now, to be self-regarding is at the same time to be other-regarding. For young people, they start to get this global village, that what they do must be sustainable, that this profound interdependence, never more dramatically highlighted, when some names with banks that I thought were Disneyland names when I first heard them, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, go down and our well-capitalised, AAA-rated banks in Australia are knocked and impacted. And financial institution failures lead to economic failures, leads to what we're living with in the global financial crisis. Profound interdependence. Which is why we're here to say this partnership really is, I think, Melbourne University, faculties like yours, with World Vision saying, we get it. We need to be other regarding. And this is no longer just about charity. This is no longer just about a little bit of spare time. This is also about my future and my children and grandchildren's future. This is about our world. To finish, we do need a world vision. A sense that we are in this together. Well, I think I've allowed a little bit of time, maybe 10 minutes for questions, so I'm going to pause. I would invite David and Rudo to come back and Phil from the university to facilitate this.
So we have a roving mic. If you've got a question, please put up your hand and the mic will find its way to you.
Thank you. I really enjoyed your talks. I wanted to ask Rudo, it was interesting to me that you had gone through a process of reflecting on what worked well and what didn't, and there was a good learning opportunity. How have you inculcated that approach to other members of World Vision Organization? Are they as responsive to continuous learning and improvement as you are?
This. Okay.
Yes. World Vision has the, I think, the opportunities to try and replicate what is happening in other parts. So we are constantly, we've got communities of practice where new and emerging ideas are shared and replicated in different countries. And a Millionaire's Mission was actually supported from World Vision UK was shown in the UK, but was also shown here in Australia. And both the UK office and World Vision Australia are really stepping up their support for sustainable economic empowerment projects. And we in Uganda, on the other hand, are also trying to, we've actually developed a business plan, which we're going to be sharing with World Vision Australia, to integrate our microenterprise wing with our ongoing development processes so that we can scale up the number of clients who are in the areas where we are doing development. And there's a huge thrust moving forward to scale up not only food security, but income security. Altogether, they feed into livelihood security. And that's a huge thrust, particularly for Africa, because of the impact of the food crisis and the economic crisis.
Next question. This one down the front.
I really enjoyed all three of you speeches, but I guess one thing that you really emphasised was this new kind of entrepreneurial approach to aid. And I was wondering, is that a real response to people like Bill Easterly and Dambisa Mayo's criticisms of the negative impacts of aid that it's had in the past?
We would all like to have a go at that one. Those who didn't hear, the bookends of the aid debate are the Bill Easterlys and, how do you pronounce her name from Zambia?
Dambisa
Moya, who really says aid's pointless and government-to-government aid is just wasted, it's corrupt government. And that's one bookend. The other bookend is Jeffrey Sachs, The End of Poverty, and the Millennium Development Villages he's developing to pilot what can be done. Look, I think the truth is actually somewhere in between. What we see is that the Easterlys and others really only focus too much on the government-to-government bilateral, as does Zambisa. She doesn't really talk about, in her book, Dead Aid, civil society and NGO aid. So if we have a community benchmarking process that says if we're building a school with the community, who should build the school? They'll always say it should be our government. Oh, well, you don't need World Vision then. I say, oh, yes, we do. We don't know where that government budget went. Well, here's the deal. We'll help you build the school on condition you allow us to train you to see what your government promised in terms of the education budget, to have the skills to track where that money went. It might have been palaces and weapons. And the advocacy skills to raise your voice, because we move out of an area where we do development after 15 years. Our whole idea is not to create dependency, but sustainability. Part of that sustainability is businesses, the entrepreneurial stuff. Now, Easterly says this is the big argument, and the rest of aid is a waste of time. The truth is that aid that deals with health and education is the foundation for entrepreneurial activity that runs businesses. If you are sick, if you don't have an education, it's very hard to be entrepreneurial. This either-or argument just, it's either aid or it's entrepreneurial activity doesn't add up. Let me finish by saying that's why we launched this morning what's called C Solutions, Social and Economic Empowerment. Some of you were at the breakfast and heard Rudo this morning. And C Solutions, which we'd invite you to have a look at, is really saying lots of Australians are business people, a couple of million small businesses in this country. They know the difficulties of running a business. Sometimes it works, sometimes you have great times, bad times. They may wish to have a portfolio investment in people in the developing world to do just that, to have their own opportunity to run a business, to be empowered. We are very committed to that. Because as I said, people at the end of the day don't want to live on aid. They want trade and a job. But setting them off as if you can have one without the other loses the insight.
Rudo or David? Question down the front.
Oh, sorry, just maybe. Yes, I think we're back in there just a little more.
I'd just make one simple point, and that is this whole debate about aid and what's involved, what's required, is not a new debate. And it really gets back to trying to understand what is the process of economic development, and we don't fully understand that. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when a book came out called The Stages of Economic Growth by an American economic historian called Walt Rostock. And that seemed to have the formula. You know, you get investment as a particular percentage of GDP as a minimum, you get that happening and various things follow. And then that was heavily criticised over time and showed that it didn't, there were as many exceptions as there were cases that seemed to fit into that structure. So, look, we're constantly looking at this. It's this constant battle between what's general and what's unique. And we find in our own programming. But I think what we are probably constantly seeing as a fairly general truth is that you've got to bring people with you. You can't come in and impose solutions. If people don't see the logic and the benefit of what you're trying to do in programs, they may be polite, they'll go along with you for a while, but the sort of point that's being made in that film, that is, you can build a potato store, but if people don't see the logic of it, they don't see the benefit from it, you end up with an empty building. So I think that's one of the things that's generic to programs, but there are plenty of differences as well. So that's why an organisation or an NGO with a long history of experience working at the grassroots should be developing a better balance between the generic and also the local differences. And it's just that really it's a constant struggle. And when we look at the final 40 or 50 poorest countries, if it was easy, that problem would have been solved. So I think we'll constantly see a pendulum of arguments between high-level multilateral assistance, low-level microfinance, small-scale assistance. It'll fluctuate between the two, but it will be some sort of mix of both, and it will vary from case to case.
Sorry, we just maybe just bringing some realities also from Uganda. I know that there's a lot of scepticism around aid and whether it works or not, but coming from communities where we are reaching over 132,000 children and millions of families, I know that aid, you have to make sure that you're channeling it to the right things. And it's Paul Collier who says there are some countries that are trapped because of conflict, because of being landlocked, because of bad neighbors. There are those countries that are struggling because the whole infrastructure and the framework around them pushes them down while others are moving forward. But I know at the community level, World Vision currently has 4,000 clients who are getting loans from a micro enterprise development initiative, and they are repaying back. So depending on how you channel aid and how you prepare communities and how you support them, aid can work. The question is, are governments not corrupt? Yes, they are. And it's about community initiatives that seek to hold governments accountable for how they use aid, so that the aid that goes into society through civil society and the aid that goes into bilateral agreements with governments can have the same impact on communities. And I think in that way we can improve the quality of aid.
Question here. Di?
Actually, Rudo, before you sit down, my question's to you. It's actually about the Millionaire's Mission, and it was wonderful when you described, or when the video also described the kind of ripple effect that occurred after the word got around and people saw how successful it was. I also wonder if there were any ripples once the millionaires returned home, because clearly they would have been changed by the experience that they'd had. Were there ongoing benefits that you could see as a result of their experiences when they went back to their communities?
I would hope yes, but on the millionaires you win, you mean? I think their commitment to continue supporting the teach-in initiative by keeping it on their websites, because two of their millionaires, Deirdre, who runs a business that sends out volunteers, she has kept the teach-in on her website. And Seb Bishop, who's also into media marketing, has continued to keep the teach-in on his websites. So they have seen the benefit of continuing to link in, but they also didn't want to keep themselves locked in to this project, because that's not what they do. They just got back to their lives and they found ways of continuing supporting the projects without really putting in any more money. By the way, these millionaires each put in 15,000. pounds to actually come on the visit and to fund all the projects that happened during that time. So in a way, they have continued to be connected, but the idea was that they would be there for 3 weeks, and hopefully what they did would be sustainable. So they were not allowed by World Vision UK to keep going back, because the question was, will it be a sustainable solution to poverty? And we found that some of the interventions have sort of had some hiccups in terms of getting up and going, and some have worked better. And fortunately, it's a community where World Vision is still working, so we can pick up and support the communities to keep going.
Thank you, Rudo. Our time has come to an end, so I'd like to finish up with three notes of reflection and thanks. Firstly, reflecting on the World Vision University of Melbourne partnership, I think clearly today is a demonstration of the power of that partnership to enrich us as a learning community, giving us a stronger sense of global perspective. There are other events coming up, and I would just note that we have two One Just World events in Melbourne, one of which will be in November 24th, looking at global health, and another in February, which looks at this question of good aid, bad aid, and what's the difference. I'd like to very much thank Rudo, Tim, and David for their presentations that have been both informational and inspirational, and we very much appreciate that. And I'd like to thank you as an audience. I've been inspired and informed today, and hearing comes with a level of responsibility, and I think today has moved us on and hopefully moves us to act in ways where we might creatively act, intelligently act to make a difference in the world in which we live. So thank you, one and all.